The fourth case for oral argument today is Hall v. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Curl for the appellant, John Philip Hall. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, the Foreclosure Fairness Act, passed by the legislature in 2011, states that its intent is to reduce the incidence of foreclosure in Washington State. When a bank or lender engages in conduct clearly at odds with that legislative intent, as the respondents Chase and Wells Fargo have here, such conduct must be sanctioned. In fact, the OCC had already sanctioned Chase Bank back in 2015 for similar misconduct and failing to act in good faith with homeowners to obtain home loan modifications. The respondents, Chase Bank and Wells Fargo here, have advanced the argument that no loan modification was permitted because the loan was in the name of the appellant's ex-wife. Clearly, though, the legislature saw fit to amend the FFA to expressly prohibit the type of procedural obstacles that lenders had been engaging in to obstruct reasonable efforts by former spouses.
What's the effective date of that statute?
The effective date was June 21st, 2014, as far as the specific provision.
How does that affect your argument?
It's my position that while that specific point may not have been entirely ripe, it's my position that the overall legislative intent of the Foreclosure Fairness Act is to reduce the incidence of foreclosure in Washington. That requires the parties to a mediation as required under the FFA to engage in a good faith mediation, and I don't believe that that's what had occurred here.
If you have co-borrowers on a loan, is it bad faith for the lender to say we can't really entertain a modification of a loan unless we have both co-borrowers at the table?
Well, again, the facts in this situation were that the appellant had received title to the property through an agreed decree of dissolution. Obviously...
How does that answer the question? Didn't the ex-wife still have liability to the bank on the loan?
Well, as the Freddie Mac guidelines, which are also at issue here, demonstrate, they in fact, could submit a loan application for...
But the law in Washington is that if husband and wife get divorced, the people who are obliged to the third-party creditor before the divorce are still obliged to the creditor after the divorce. In this case, it appears it was just the wife who had the obligation to the creditor. How could you negotiate the terms of her obligation without her either authorizing someone to act on her behalf or being at the table?
Well, that's essentially what we're asking. It would be our position that an expansive view of the legislative intent of the Foreclosure Fairness Act is called for here. Otherwise you would sort of have this situation.
Well, let's turn on our heads. Let's say they negotiated with your client and they reduced the monthly payments and extended the loan for 10 years. And in next last year of the extended loan, there's a default and they don't want the property. They just want to sue on the note and they go after the ex-wife, and she says, statute of limitations, you had 6 years after this note became due. I never agreed to any extension. What's the answer to that?
Well, I believe that the objective of the appellant here was to assume the loan modification individually. There was no...
Well, that may be his objective, but couldn't the bank be concerned that he might default in the future since apparently he hadn't made the payments after the divorce, and that was the reason folks were in this position to start with?
I would submit that if as the Freddie Mac guidelines provide a non-borrower, such as a person in the appellant's position, could assume the loan. That doesn't necessarily need to be an issue. I mean, arguably, I mean, the decree required that...
What's the bank say to its shareholders if it doesn't do anything to protect its right to collect from the one person it loaned the money to?
Given, I mean, this is obviously not an uncommon situation where parties get divorced and one party receives a loan.
Well, usually decrees that I've seen are drafted a little more carefully than this, and this problem won't arise.
That may be the case, Your Honor. I didn't draft that.
I'm not suggesting you did.
Certainly. Nevertheless, I mean, in the context of the intent, obviously, of the foreclosure crisis in 2008, 2011, that period, you know, parties getting divorced is not an uncommon situation. Obviously, at, you know, although the law had, the amendment to the law had been passed in early 2014, I mean, that clearly indicates that the legislature was seeking to have this act, this amendment, treat situations such as this as broadly as possible. I would submit that the amendment was passed because...
Are you suggesting that all statutes with effective dates are retroactive to the date of enactment?
No, I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor, but I... Obviously, the Foreclosure Fairness Act itself was passed in 2011, and it's designed to create a framework for lenders and borrowers to engage in good faith, and that there's nothing that actually expressly prohibits a lender from engaging with a borrower that would have been in the shoes of the appellant here. The respondents would seek to make the, again, you know, no one is claiming here that the bank had an affirmative obligation to accept the assumption of the loan, but given that they took a loan application and supporting financial documentation, they had an obligation consistent with the FFA to actually review it. That did not occur here. I would submit even more so in light of the loan guarantor Freddie Mac's guidelines requiring that loan modification obligations be submitted to it for final review and approval. While the respondents seek to make the argument here that Mr. Hall was a stranger to the note, this is something of a disingenuous position, given, again, that the FFA was ultimately amended to allow a former spouse to be treated as a borrower and that they had a completely separate obligation under the Freddie Mac guidelines to submit his loan application for a good faith review. In the McGarvey case cited in our briefing, the court there found that Chase Bank owed a duty of care to the plaintiff in that case because it had requested financial documentation and undertook the processing of a loan modification application.
So we agreed with you. How would your client establish the measure of a measure of damages?
Well, I mean, that's obviously potentially a laborious factual determination, but I think that...
You have no obligation to accept the application. What's the harm?
If they have no to the application of the borrower?
Your client. Go ahead and answer. I use the word borrower because that's perhaps the note maker.
I would just admit that he...
Well, why don't you think about it and maybe on rebuttal you
can. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for my colleague, Joe McIntosh, here, Your Honors.
I'll rely on co-counsel to monitor their own time.
He can jab me. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Fred Burnside. I'm here today representing JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo Bank as trustee. What I want to do this morning is three basic things. First, I want to explain why the theories under the Foreclosure Fairness Act fail. Second, I want to address why there's no unfair or deceptive act or practice under the CPA and no injury. And third, if there's time, to talk about why the court didn't abuse its discretion in denying leave to amend. Before getting into that, I do want to touch on one factual issue that plaintiff's counsel just raised up here. The suggestion that he, you know, wasn't considered for modification simply isn't true. At CP 267, they actually ran through the NPV analysis and learned that with this guy's income, you'd have to have a negative interest rate of 4% or write off over $250,000. So he was reviewed. It's just this guy, you know, Judge Leach made a good point. What's a bank going to do or say to its shareholders in a situation like that? That's where you have a totally different credit risk from one borrower to the next. And so the fact that his ex-wife may have had great credit such that they're happy with the loan is great. It's one thing. He doesn't. He doesn't have the income to support it. But in any event, I wanted to clarify that factual point and then move on to the FFA. His theory is defendants failed to mediate in good faith. The mediator certified the opposite. That's at CP 266. The same certificate, as I said, explains that modification would require a negative interest rate or a huge write-down of over $250,000. More importantly, you know, the Department of Commerce guidelines explain that plaintiff had to comply with their requirements, one of which was you got to have a power of attorney from the borrower. You can't go in and modify someone else's loan, especially where, as noted at CP 26, she says, I don't want him to modify my loan. I don't want to assume my loan. I want this thing to foreclose. And that's what the real injury here is, not to him. It's to his ex-wife, who's having negative credit reporting continuing to this day because of this litigation, because we can't foreclose while this is going on. We're enjoined. So ultimately, he offered no evidence on summary judgment to demonstrate a lack of good faith and fair dealing. I'm sorry, good faith under the FFA. And he makes the point, well, you know, a lender could. That's just not true, actually. As we pointed out in our briefing, under the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, federal statute, we would be barred from revealing the financial information of the borrower to a non-borrower without their express consent. That's why it parallels the guidelines. You need permission from a borrower to reveal their private financial information.
That's the form of a release, though, rather than a power of attorney.
Yes, something in writing, clearly. But yes, that's absolutely right, Your Honor. Again, I think Your Honor hit the nail on the head with respect to the statutory amendment. It wasn't in effect. The amendment also says that a lender has no affirmative duty to assume the loan. And more importantly, we did treat him as a borrower. We said, you know, you can show up, come to the mediation, see what you can do, but you got to have the actual borrower on the hook. You can't modify someone else's loan if they haven't agreed to it. So
he also would have had available to him the opportunity to make a new loan with the lender and simply pay this one off and be in the position that he's trying to get through renegotiation.
Correct. He had an opportunity to refinance the loan if he could qualify for refinance. In fact, that's what his dissolution decree says, is she's going to transfer any title in the property that she has to him. But he's got 6 months to refinance the loan, taking her off it, or after that, if that doesn't happen, sell the thing based on three appraisers with the value going down by 5% every 90 days until it sells. That hasn't happened. And the notion that he has title of the property is actually in dispute as well. At footnote one of our response to the amicus brief, we point out the county's records show they transferred the title of the property to a trust in 2011. He doesn't even have title to the property. But I want to get to the CPA claim as well and address that because I think the FFA claim fails. You know, it's not unfair to refuse to modify a loan. That seems to be it. Like, he seems to be arguing you have an obligation to consider me because of not the text of the FFA, but the purpose behind the FFA to modify my loan. And there's just nothing supporting that.
How about to falsely represent what Freddie Mac's position is?
A few things. One, that appears nowhere in the complaint. It's never alleged. It was raised for the first time in response, in reply in summary judgment, and the court denied leave to amend. Second, as you just pointed out, Freddie Mac was the guarantor of the loan. Freddie Mac wasn't the owner of the loan. Wells Fargo's trustee was the owner of the loan. So Chase was servicing that for Wells Fargo, not for Freddie Mac. So Freddie Mac's guidelines, first of all, don't even apply. Second, the Freddie Mac guidelines.
There's no obligation to refinance. If a bank acted in bad faith through the negotiating process, and you could say, for example, look, five other people in the same financial yep. situation got refinanced, then there would be a cause of action, wouldn't there?
There could potentially be a cause of action if it basically came forward and said, we just don't like this guy. You know, we're not doing it. Maybe under those facts, there might be something.
So there's a good faith requirement.
I would think that there is a good faith.
And you're relying on the mediator's certification of good faith.
Well, I'm relying on the mediator's certification of good faith, yes, Your Honor. At the same time, I also don't think, I think any requirement that a lender modify a loan under any circumstances would be preempted by the National Bank Act and the Homeowners Loan Act, depending on the lender. But that's not an issue that's before the court. But, yeah, I mean, under different facts, maybe there's a claim, but I just don't see it here, especially when, you know, you have to write off over $250,000 to qualify for anything.
Even though entitled loan modification application, was the application broader in scope? Could it be read to include the potential for a refinance?
No, it's an entirely different program. You know, refinance, the Home Affordable Modification Program is a federal program dealing expressly with, you know, loan modifications. A refinance is an entirely new loan. One is modifying the existing loan, obviously, and the other is an entirely new loan with new obligations and terms. And one would suspect that, you know, with an obligation to refinance, if he could have refinanced, he would have. He couldn't. So ultimately, he has offered no evidence of an unfair subjective practice, and more importantly, no injury. As I said before, the only injury here is to his ex-wife, who's affirmatively said, sell this thing. I want to move on. Moreover, on the Freddie Mac points, the provisions he cite talk about a spouse who died, not one who simply divorced. The other provision he talks about dealing with divorced spouses didn't go into effect until September 2014. That's at CP 598. So, his final argument for injury is that under Frias, you know, if a more favorable modification would have resulted but for bad faith in mediation, there might be an injury. That's what, Judge Leach, I think you're getting at. The record here shows there was no bad faith. He was considered. It's regrettable that he can't afford it, but that's life. It was plaintiff's obligation to provide evidence showing he could have obtained a better deal, and he couldn't. There's no evidence of an unfair deceptive act or practice, no injury, no causation by my clients, clearly, and so the CPA claim fails. Lastly, I want to touch on leave to amend. But the trial court didn't abuse its discretion in denying leave to amend. He'd already amended his complaint once, and he sought leave to amend less than a week before the summary judgment hearing at the last minute, and we cited authority, and the judge agreed that amendment's prejudicial at that point with trial coming up and summary judgment being argued. More importantly, the local rules require that he interlineate the changes and, among other things, and put proposed and denominated as unsigned. It's undisputed. He didn't do that. He didn't comply with the local rules necessary to seek leave to amend, so it was not abuse of discretion to deny him leave to amend on that basis, in addition to the prejudice. Moreover, it would be futile. Those amendments couldn't save anything because Freddie Mac isn't a party to this loan. Defendants mediated in good faith. No unfair deceptive act or practice. We think the court should affirm the summary judgment in the trial court.
Your Honor, it's Joe McIntosh on behalf of the trustee Quality Loan. Quality was joined as a defendant in this action, and the allegation against Quality is that they've breached a trustee duty to the appellant here. The problem with that argument is that the trustee duties run with the beneficiary of the deed of trust. They run with the grantor of the deed of trust and the borrower under the note. That's the ex-wife. That's Wells Fargo. The trustee does not have any statutory duty of good faith to the appellant. In this case, it's undisputed. There was a loan default that triggered the trustees.
Instead of a divorce, the note maker had sold the property to a third party subject to the loan, so the bank wasn't required to approve the transaction. And there was substantial equity in the property at the time of default, and the borrower came in and said, I've got a buyer next week. Please continue the sale for a week. No duty?
Well, this wasn't the borrower coming in, Your Honor. This was
not the borrower. Excuse me. The purchaser, I misspoke. The purchaser comes in. Please extend it for 1 week.
No, because the trustee's duties statutorily are owed to the appellant and to, or not to the appellant, but to the borrower, grantor, and to the bank. And in this case, factually, both those parties were instructing the trustee to go to sale. Now, the power of sale was triggered because there's a default. No allegation that the appointment was invalid. So the trustee, in going to sale, is following its statutory duties. Third parties cannot come in and direct the trustee what to do. Its duties are clear. And so, again, factually in this case, the foreclosure was appropriate. It was advanced pursuant to law in all respects. There are no claims for relief against the trustee. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. To briefly address the respondent's arguments regarding the CPA claim and the misrepresentations, the CPA claim was, in fact, part of the original complaint in this matter. And so I believe that the bank's misrepresentations as to the availability of loan modification relief under the Freddie Mac guidelines.
So you, for a CPA claim, you have to show damages caused by the bank's action. What would those damages be?
Well, I mean, essentially, you know, he's got, you know, expended a great amount of resources, you know, attempting to pursue a modification. He stands to lose his home as a result of this. I mean, the damages, you know, could potentially be significant. Well, are significant.
Wouldn't that only be true if the bank was obliged to modify the loan?
Well, if he in fact could obtain, I don't.
You haven't made a claim that the bank breached a duty to modify. You've made a claim that they didn't consider your client's application appropriately. At least that's how I understand the case.
Certainly. Well, there is that element of the claim, but there are also the claims regarding the bank's misrepresentations, just simply about the availability of loan relief in the first place. I mean, that is, I think, on its face, a fairly unfair and deceptive business practice, you know, both in pleadings filed with the court. You know, I would also want to address the, you know, as far as the amended motion for leave to amend the complaint, again, it perhaps would have been more procedurally convenient to discover this evidence of this misrepresentation sooner in the case. Nevertheless, the evidence was presented to the court, and leave to amend should have been granted.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.